Over the last three episodes, we've explored the life of Lee Harvey Oswald from the time he was born until he enlisted in the Marines. Whenever we reach the end of a topic on solving JFK, we go back and we recap the material that we covered in the podcast episodes and also address any rebuttal points that are raised, all with the goal of making a determination on any disputed questions. And look, I'll be the first to admit that the material that we've been covering in the Young Oswald series is not as exciting as other parts of the case. And I could have covered Oswald's childhood in a single episode if not for all of the disputes surrounding the timeline of Oswald's addresses, schools, and jobs. But the fact that there are all of these disputes about those issues tells me that I need to cover those topics if I'm serious about examining the case. So in this recap and rebuttals episode, I'll be joined by NFL executive, sports writer, broadcaster, and JFK assassination enthusiast, Michael Lombardi. We'll go over the many document and timeline conflicts and talk about the life of young Lee Harvey Oswald.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting. The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton.
I have the privilege today of being joined by Michael Lombardi. Michael has worn many hats in his professional career, most of them having to do with the National Football League. He's worked in NFL front offices going back to 1984 when he won a Super Bowl ring under 49ers coach Bill Walsh. He was the general manager for my favorite NFL team, the Cleveland Browns. And then he won two Super Bowl rings with the New England Patriots after that. Michael has worked for pretty much every sports media outlet covering the NFL, and he's also the author of two books. Most recently, Football Done Right, Setting the Record Straight on the Coaches, Players, and History of the NFL. Michael, welcome to Solving JFK. Thanks for joining us.
Matt, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I love listening to it every week. I'm a diehard, so I appreciate you having me on, and I'm looking forward to learning more about Lee Harvey's youth.
Absolutely. When did you first become interested in the JFK assassination? Because I know you're not just casually interested. You're really, really down in the weeds with all the rest of the researchers. When did that start for you?
Yeah, my wife wishes I was, and I have like a whole entire bookcase filled with books on it. I was about 14, 15 years old, and I was working in a restaurant here in this little beach town called Ocean City, New Jersey, where I grew up. And there was a bunch of guys that were older than me that were going to Temple, and they were all looking at this book. You thought it was a Playboy magazine, but it was like a book, and they were like just locked in, and they were just, the Umbrella Man was the theme of the book, right? Like, why would this guy have an umbrella up in the middle of this, you know, of a sunny day in Dallas? And that got me thinking, like, wow, wait a minute. And then from there, I read one book to another book. And then as you go down this, even if you go down the rabbit hole a little bit, you realize that nothing makes sense. Like, you can't make sense of it all. And then when you're able to uncover and you learn about the magic bullet theory, you know, then you're just like crazy. And then I remember that year, because my grades were so shitty, I had to go to Valley Forge Military Academy. And so we did a field trip down to Dallas, and I ran into Arlen Specter at this field trip that we were on. And I said to Specter, like, how you, like, I was a senior in high school, and I'm like, how do you really explain that? And he said, young man, I'll send you this report that I wrote, and it's completely, you know, accurate. And he sent it to my dorm room at Company C at Valley Forge Military Academy. And I read that, and I still thought he was full of shit, you know? And so that's kind of where it all started. And it hasn't really stopped. It really hasn't. I think the momentum that you brought to the table, Stone brings to the table, Jim brings to the table, and now Rob Reiner, I think it's starting to change the tenor and the landscape of people. You know, there was always this viewpoint that you're a kook if you thought that, or you're, you know, it's like you're in some closet in Des Moines in a basement, you know, whereas there are professional people that are reading this stuff.
Sure. Yeah, that's crazy. So you actually met Arlen Specter, you challenged him, and then he actually did what he said he was going to do. He followed up and sent you a report that was probably, you know, the Warren Report section on the magic bullet.
It was like a pamphlet. Like, it was like a pamphlet size thing. It was white. I don't have it anymore. I wish I kept it. But, you know, and then I read it in my dorm room. The lights had to go out at 10:15. You had study hall at 9:30. And I would read that thing. And I'm like, this makes no sense at all. You know, I thought, you know, I still think every time I talk about the magic bullet, I think of Walter Matthau in the movie, that crazy bullet going, you know, like it made no sense. But I tell you what, the other thing that really, Matt, the thing that, to me, this is a broader issue of this case, is there's a narrative that gets created, whether it's in pro football, whether it's in sports, whether it's in something, that the media creates a narrative. And that narrative will never go away because that's what the media wants to create. And part of the attraction for me for this case is this never-ending desire by our media to continue with the narrative when they know it's not true, you know, when they know it's not, and they won't ever correct themselves. You know, I had a great coach in the NFL tell me one time some of the sports networks, they're not interested in reporting the story. They're interested in creating the story.
Sure.
And so this case is symbolic of what else is wrong with our country in terms of, we think we live in this world where we're getting information unfiltered. No, we're not. We're not. And that's what I think that's what resonates with me the most, why I'm fascinated with this, because they're a broader issue than just who did it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I completely agree with you about, you know, just it is a nice microcosm of the case overall, because, you know, it's kind of how like politics are today. People just kind of talk right past each other. There's no synthesis. The media is making stories out of nothing. And the case does kind of mirror that. What are some of your favorite books? And also, I should ask you first, you land more on the Warren Report critic side, right?
Oh yeah, no question. I mean, I don't see how anybody can believe the magic bullet. Because if you're on the Warren side, if you believe Alan Dulles' creation, because we know that, like at some point, I know that the airport was named after his brother, but at some point we got to change that name. But I mean, if you believe that, if you're on the Warren side, you have to believe the bullet. And you know, that's, nobody can believe the bullet. So that just, to me, that just does that. So, I mean, I think anything that Talbert's written, I think, is brilliant. The Devil's Chessboard is one of my favorite books. I think it really, Brothers is another one. I think there's more to this than meets the eye, that you have to kind of understand. One of the things David Halberstam, the great writer who passed away, actually trying to write a book on Y.A. Tittle, he got in a car accident in San Francisco. The things that he always does with his books is he brings you into the moment of the world that he's explaining to you, so you can see it through the eyes of the people that are living there at that time. And I think you have to understand this case, you have to understand the time. And I'm not sure we really do. If you don't understand what was going on in the late 50s and what Eisenhower was doing and what Truman didn't want to do in terms of the whole, you know, even though the Truman book by McCullough is not about the Kennedy assassination, there's parts in it, you know, and all the LBJ books by Robert Caro, which are my favorite books. I met Caro once, and after I read his chapter on the assassination, he never wrote Lee Harvey Oswald in that chapter. He never used his name.
Wow, that's something. Well, and let me ask you this: is there anybody, to your knowledge, in the NFL who has a similar interest in the JFK assassination?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of guys that do.
They may
Probably
not want to
my
be outed.
no, I think that you like Chris Caputo, the head basketball coach at George
Oh, yeah.
Washington University. Chris is a great friend of mine, and we basically banter back and forth on this all the time. He'll send me. I think he sent me your podcast. That's how I got in touch with you. He
Oh,
sent
yeah.
me your podcast, and that, you know, and then Jefferson Morley's blog. I kind of got in touch with that, and actually, I think Morley's going to go to a George Washington basketball game.
Oh,
So,
nice.
yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of people that you know, they want to get into it, you know, because it's a rabbit hole that you can go down and you can't really get out of. I
Right.
mean, you could just go down the Tibbett rabbit hole, or you could go down the sixth floor rabbit hole, or there's so many you could go down. The Ruby rabbit hole, you
Yeah.
know, the Dorothy Kilgallen rabbit hole. I mean, you go down all these. Now, I'm not saying it's going to lead you to the answer, but they go fairly deep.
Well, speaking of the rabbit hole, shall we dive in? Let's
Sure.
go on young Oswald here. All right, so just some general observations before we get into the disputed issues. What we're going to do here in this recap and rebuttals episode is kind of, just summarize what were the main things we covered in this series. And then I have five rebuttals that were sent in. We'll talk about those and then we'll make conclusions. So here we go. Just looking at Oswald's life generally, he had a sad early life. He moved around a lot. The whole story about his mom at the orphanage, dropping him off and then coming back to get him again. And by the way, I got emails about that. I probably could have spoken about that a little bit nicer, but I was trying to be funny. But the point is, his mom did drop him off, and then she kind of
Yeah.
just checked him back out later again. But we don't really know what she was going through. But Oswald, he's moving all the time. His older brothers are both gone by the time he's in middle school when he moves to New York. And then, there's the whole conversation about was he violent or not. If you read Gerald Posner, you think he's a very violent
Yeah.
guy. He's just fighting everybody. But it looks like there is this one incident with the knife in New York. And then he didn't cut anybody with a knife, but he did pull a knife on his half brother's wife. And then he hit his mom. This is, according to, I believe what Mark, this was according to Marguerite Oswald, what she said, and to John Pick's testimony. So I give credibility to it because of the John Pick side of it. But we don't have a lot of other instances of Oswald being violent, except for the fight in New Orleans. Two fights. One time he's beat up, and then one time he actually participates and hits a kid and gets hit back. So I kind of where I land on, the Oswald, is he violent or not? I would say he's not a pushover, but he's not out there actively starting fights. What was your sense of whether or not he was a violent kid?
Well, I think a lot of it, you know, I spent my career studying people, right? You know, when you work in the NFL and you're responsible for building a draft board, character and understanding people are the one of the main criteria of the job. And so, you know, you read a lot about really screwed up childhoods, right? I mean, some of the players, sometimes I'll interview a player, Matt, and I'll say, you know, I'm in awe of you for where you've been able to get to based on your childhood. Like what you've gone through in life to get where you are today, I'm in awe of you. And I don't get that sense from Oswald. I get the sense that he probably was a kid because of his upbringing, didn't trust very many people. And so I think trust was hard. And I think when you don't trust, you know, your dog loves you for the day, but if you try to do something to your dog, you know, they may growl at you know, even though
Right.
the dog's gonna lick you later. So I kind of I didn't I think to me this whole violent character is a creation of what we want to sell the broader picture to. I think to me, you know, if he were that violent, would they have put him on the most secure base in Japan? They don't just send anybody over there. Like they do testing on that. They're not going to trust somebody who has a past of a violence. So to me, you know, there's a bias called apanonia, and it's a tendency to perceive a connection of a meaningful pattern between unrelated random things. Sure. And I think this is what we're dealing with in a lot of this stuff. People want to connect dots because everybody sees this as a murder mystery. And all murder mysteries, we want to bring in, we want to bring in Jessica Fletcher and have her tell us who did it.
Yeah.
And this ain't this one. This isn't one of those things you can do.
Yeah, there's a lot of dissonant facts, that's for sure. All right, so we're going to cover a lot of just different disputes when it comes to the evidence, specifically when it comes to the documents, the timelines. So we're going to be talking about documents here a lot. I think it's important here to go ahead and give the John Armstrong disclaimer here. So let's talk about that. There's a guy named John Armstrong who wrote a book called Harvey and Lee. He went to the National Archives for a long time. I want to say more than 10 years, 10, 15 years. He would go for like a month at a time, get an apartment, and then just dive in and spend full days going through the National Archives. And in doing that, the end product of that was his book, Harvey and Lee. But he has an elaborate theory in Harvey and Lee, which I'm going to cover in depth at some point here. But I want to separate two things because people are going to go, oh, you're talking about John Armstrong? Yes, I am talking about John Armstrong. And I think whether or not you end up buying his theory, which is that there were two Oswalds, from the time they were about, you know, it's basically kind of, we cover all these discrepancies. His theory is that you overlay the idea that there's a Harvey and a Lee on top of that. And that may or may not be true. I don't know. I agree with anyone who says that that sounds insane and you should write it off right away. If you want to do that, I completely understand. But what we can't do is write off the documents. And John Armstrong did a tremendous service to everyone who's interested in the JFK assassination. I put him up there with like Sylvia Marr in terms of going through the documents, like just getting his hands dirty and just like the effort that it must have taken to compile all this. So definitely a shout out to John Armstrong. But I do just want to point out that you can disagree with John Armstrong on his theory and say, nah, that's a crazy theory. But, you know, it's not just one or two times where he's showing a conflict. There are dozens of times, maybe 100 times, you know, that he shows specific conflicts. It only takes that him to be right one or two times for that to be a huge problem. So we're vetting these disputed things. And there's my Harvey and Lee disclaimer. All right. So the next thing is 7408 Ewing. And the idea is he went to elementary school at Benbrook Common School. And then 2 years later, he ended up going to a different elementary school. Actually, he starts going to Benbrook in 1945, fall of 1945, leaves Benbrook in January of 1946. So he's there for less than half a year. Then he ends up moving in to this address, 7408 Ewing, in August of 1948. So more than 2 years after he was gone from Benbrook. But nevertheless, on the Benbrook enrollment card, it has his future address of 7408 Ewing. So, you know, I think what this is supposed to show is, wait a minute, is there some weird foreknowledge of the future? What's going on here? Like, is this the whole Harvey and Lee shell game? I don't know. But here's rebuttal number one. And this is from YouTube comments. Probably what happened was that a future school contacted Benbrook and asked to confirm that Oswald had attended there. And then when they called, they provided his current address, which at the time was 7408 Ewing. So it wouldn't have been foreknowledge of the future. It just would have been someone updating the record. Now that's possible. I think that is a possible interpretation. But we don't know that. That's just speculation about something that could have happened. Another possibility is that, you know, this document is a forgery trying to lay some sort of trail. But that also is speculation. We really just don't know. So to me, it does seem a little weird, but I don't think there's enough to hang your hat on of any sort of smoking gun on this particular form. But you do just mark it down as something weird. What about you, Michael?
I think this is, you know, I think it's weird. I don't think there's a linkage here. I think we look at this data through our eyes today as if we have iPhones and we could write everything down. I think there's a bigger margin for mistakes back at this time when all this stuff was going on. you know, and I'm not sure that our memories are as powerful as we think they are. So that's kind of how I see it. I can't understand it. Here's what I do know. The end game, I don't believe somebody was creating two Lees, two Oswalds this early. Like that one, I have a hard time getting my arms around. So I kind of think this is more of a clerical mistake than anything.
Sure. And that very well could be. And that's the other thing about the whole Armstrong theory. Well, he could be right about part of it, but not all of it. So right. I would just encourage everyone to sort of pick issue by issue. Don't pick a I love John Armstrong or I hate John Armstrong political party. Vote on the issues, I say.
yeah. All right. I mean, you're right. His book is incredible, though. It's an incredible research. I mean, the man, I don't know how he did it. I really don't. I mean, he would be wonderful to run into a draft room with. I mean, he could research the hell out of players.
Well, you know, if he hears you say that, you might get a phone call.
Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC. It's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these. So when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click shop by mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. So visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
All right. The next topic we're going to talk about, San Saba. So in particular, here's what the discrepancy is. Marguerite Oswald bought the house at 101 San Saba in July of 1947, but she also lived at 1505 8th Avenue in Fort Worth at that time, based on other information. So there's this tension of where did she live? What's going on? Why are they in two places at the same time, apparently here? So when it comes to 101 San Saba, again, she bought it July 7th, 1947. We know that because there are the Tarrant County land deed records. So that definitely happened. There also were neighbors that saw Marguerite and Lee living there. So playing in the house, being there every day. They're not saying that she owned it and she leased it. They said, you know, she was there every day. Now, John Pick was asked about San Saba during his Warren Commission testimony, and he said, "San Saba? I don't know nothing about San Saba." It was great. I don't even know what he sounded like, but in my mind, that's what he sounded like.
I love it.
It's not listed at all in any addresses where Oswald lived, but there are FBI reports about it. So there's the commission exhibit. It's in my citations. I forget what it is right now, but it's the one that summarizes all of his addresses. San Saba is not there. So the official story is that he never lived there. But again, we know for sure that Marguerite owned it, and that there are multiple neighbors who say that, you know, they would give her rides places when she needed a ride. Their kids would play with Lee. So there's also the whole thing where Robert Oswald is testifying, and it comes to the time where he would talk about San Saba, this summer of 1947. Alan Dulles calls for a break, and then when he comes back from break, he skips ahead. So that was something. Maybe it's nothing, you know, but it's pretty interesting. And then on the Fort Worth 1505 8th Avenue side, Oswald did go to school at Lily B. Clayton Elementary, which was 0.2 miles from that 1505 8th Avenue address. And John Pick says the family lived there the whole summer because he worked at the nearby ice cream parlor where he would work. But again, that conflicts with what the neighbor said. So my conclusion on this is that, you know, the whole thing is, was Marguerite a landlord of San Saba, or did she also live there? In other words, could there be two different Marguerites? You know, this is another one where we do have multiple witnesses. There's a lot more on this than the other one. To me, I still land inconclusive for this. This is not enough to be like, aha, two Oswalds. But it is weird, in particular, the witness, the neighbors who said they actually lived there in light of John Pick's testimony. What do you think, Michael?
Well, the thing that bothers me is anytime Alan Dulles gets his hands on something and changes the course, you know it's important. You know it's important. Now, I can't find the importance. You know, the secret to all victory lies in the organization of the not obvious. So this looks not obvious to me, right? And so, like, but when Dulles wants to interject something and makes an attempt, and we know Dulles, like, we know this is not a good person. Like, we know this is not somebody that you want, right? That raises a red flag. Like, I don't know where it all fits in the landscape of something, but if Dulles's fingerprints are on it, and we know she doesn't have enough money to own two homes, like, my question is, how did she get the money to buy the first house? She always seemed like she was poor her whole life. Right. So there's something here that I can't really put my fingerprint on. And if Dulles wants to skip over it, to me, it sends up red flags.
Sure. Yeah. So again, it's one more thing, but it's not necessarily conclusive. Moving on to truancy in New York. So when Oswald is going into seventh grade, he and his mom move up to New York. They move in with his half-brother, John Pick, for just a little bit. They have an infant. John and his wife have an infant in this tiny apartment in New York, and it's just super cramped. Long story short, Marguerite was driving everybody crazy. We had the one time where Lee freaked out that we talked about earlier, but Lee ends up going to a couple different schools. He only attends 25% of the required days, and this wasn't something that happened at all before. This is a brand new development with the truancy. So that leads to him basically going to juvenile detention for 3 weeks. He's incarcerated at youth house, and there he's diagnosed with personality pattern disturbance with schizoid features and passive aggressive tendencies. So, but important to note, the person who diagnosed him with that, Dr. Renatus Hartogs, didn't think that he needed to, you know, he was so out of control that he needed to, you know, be detained. And the whole crazy story in New York, the showstopper, because a lot of it's just background, we learn about what's going on with Oswald. The showstopper is that we have Officer Felicia Spritzer picking up a Lee Harvey Oswald on April 16th, 1953. Now, the whole question, and we know the reason that matters is that at that time, he's supposed to be in youth house, I believe April 14th or April 15th, but certainly he was supposed to be already, you know, committed at that time. So he couldn't be out on the street, of course. So there is the issue of, she could have just got the date wrong. It could have been an authentic, legitimate report, but here's why that's wrong. I just remembered why that's wrong. Lee Harvey Oswald in the youth house wasn't arrested by a cop on the street. He wasn't arrested by someone named Felicia Spritzer. He was immediately remanded into the custody of the state as soon as the hearing was over. So this is why that's particularly strange. Where did this document come from? Well, it's a strange, the National Journal reporter. It's like some newspaper that I wasn't super familiar with, but I came across it through an FBI report about the newspaper article. So I have to, and it's literally just the newspaper article itself scanned into the FBI report. So to me, this is very interesting. But I just got to leave it as one more. Like, that's kind of a red flag, but I don't have any other corroborating facts to go on. So that's where I land on the whole Felicia Spritzer story. After that, Marguerite and Lee, they leave New York when there's a pending court date, and they basically skip town successfully with Lee not having to follow up when he really was supposed to. So what are your thoughts on the truancy and on this whole Felicia Spritzer, the two Oswalds scenario?
So they leave town. So who owns the house back in the last one? You know, did they sell that house? I mean, the one on
San Saba.
Yeah, did they sell that?
She did. She sold it to a neighbor named Otis Carlton. And I don't recall exactly when that was. It's in Harvey and Lee. We can maybe I can punch it in for everybody here. But she did sell it, and I want to say she sold it like years later. The records indicate that the house at San Saba was sold on November 6th, 1951. I want to say she sold it after she came back from New York. Like, maybe while they were living in New Orleans, she sold it or something. I'm not certain.
But she didn't take the money to go to New Orleans or leave to go back to Texas. That was my point. That's correct. What I couldn't. And so, like, to me, like, where is she getting all this money to just pick up and go? Like, all this? One thing about all this is you got to follow the money somewhere. Somebody's got to have money where it's going. And, you know, for me, I don't know what to make of the arrest dates and all that, because I think it's part of the picture they want to capture of this guy, this lone nut. You know, it seems like they want to set the stage. And sometimes when that happens, the dates don't always look good.
Right. Yeah. That's where I land pretty much on that. Although that one is really weird because he wasn't arrested by an officer. He was already in court. Okay. The next topic
is the one.
Yeah. North Dakota. So the Oswald stayed in New York until, and so the whole question here is, did Lee Harvey Oswald in particular go to North Dakota at any time during the summer of 1953? And we know that the Oswald stayed in New York until early January of 1954. We have school records for Lee. We have employment records for Marguerite Oswald showing that, you know, she's working in New York with no large blocks of time off for all of 1953. And she left her job in late December of 1953. So that's why it's so weird that there's this 12-year-old named Henry Timmer who says he was playing with Oswald in the summer of 1953 in Stanley, North Dakota. So this is a statement that he gave after, you know, he found out that he saw Lee Harvey Oswald on TV. He said, I know that guy. I hung out with that guy. We were buddies for one summer. So he told the FBI that he met Oswald while Oswald was riding his bike, and him and his friends kind of ran into him. And he said that he went by the name Harvey. The easy interpretation would be that this guy Timmer must have just made the story up, or that he's mistaken and it was really just someone else that he met, because we know that Lee and Marguerite were in New York. But Timmer told the FBI that Oswald said very specific things that sound like things Lee Harvey Oswald would say. He said that he was from New York City. He talked about communism. He showed him, he showed Timmer a Karl Marx pamphlet. And he said that he was going to kill the president one day. He told, after Oswald or Harvey told Timmer this information, Timmer told his mom about what this kid Harvey had said. Hey, this kid Harvey, he was telling me about communism and he says he's going to kill the president one day. And so Timmer's grandma, basically, that's who he was staying with, not his mom, basically said, you can't play with him anymore. So the grandma, I believe it is, because that's who he was staying with, wrote a letter to LBJ after this happened saying that her son played with Oswald and basically backed it up. And actually, that's what triggered the FBI to come and talk to Timmer. It wasn't him affirmatively reaching out. It was his mom. Now, writer Aline Mosby put in a 1963 UPI article that was actually published. The article says that Oswald told her that he lived in North Dakota and he found a copy of the book Das Kapital there. It's like a communist Marxist book. So this you know, this article is one of the, this article plus the Temer information that seems really strong to put Oswald in North Dakota. Now, here's rebuttal number two. Aline Mosby did not mention North Dakota in her Warren Commission testimony, and the only instance of it is in this 1963 UPI article. And when we look at Mosby's notes, which are CE 1385, Oswald talks about other books that he found at the New Orleans Library. So when you look at the context, it's most likely that New Orleans is what was meant and not North Dakota, and that it was just basically a transcription error. Now, I thought this was a not good argument when I first heard it, but then I came across, you know, I dug into the actual notes, you know, and the part where Mosby wrote North Dakota, and she talks about Oswald told her that he found Das Kapital in North Dakota, and then after that he went to all these other libraries and all the best libraries of New Orleans, and he would find all these great books on the dusty shelves of New Orleans in the same article. So it seems like he's referencing libraries in New Orleans. It does to me, based on what the original notes say. But nevertheless, so I kind of take Mosby's North Dakota thing and give that a lot less weight, maybe even take it off the table. But Temer and his mom may be telling the truth, or Temer and his grandma, whoever it is, I got to look it up. It's the same person. And it's a weird thing to make up if they're not telling the truth. I mark this one as inconclusive, but it's very strange. And it seems like something, there's a lot of these things where, yeah, they could be making it up, but is everybody making something up? That's what I file this under.
Well, I mean, what 15-year-old kid, because Oswald's 15 at the time of the North Dakota incident, what 15-year-old kid's talking about killing a president? And in 53, the president was Dwight Eisenhower, so why would he want to kill him? You know, he just won the war for the country. So, you know, it makes no sense. 15-year-old kids are looking to smoke cigarettes in 1953, smoke cigarettes, chase girls. You know, like, who's talking about communism when you're 15? I mean, I don't even know what communism is at 15, right? I mean, so like, to me, this is Operation Mockingbird. This is exactly what the CIA wants to do. Put a story out there, make it look like this kid's been, and they believe, and you know, look, if we'll believe the single bullet theory, we'll believe anything, right? So why not? If we're stupid enough to believe, we can believe this 12-year-old kid told his mom he didn't want to play with him anymore. Like, I have aspirations to be a baseball player. I have aspirations to be an NFL coach. I have aspirations to write a book. Who has aspirations to kill a president at 15?
Right.
I mean, like, yeah. It makes no sense at all. Like, and if you have those aspirations, you're deranged. Like, you're probably somebody who's, you know, people realize you're a really weird kid. You know, like, that makes no, this makes this whole North Dakota thing seems like a complete plant by the CIA.
So you think it maybe never happened, and this is just a story that got placed. But if they placed that story, then wouldn't it, you know, call into question the timeline, just like Armstrong kind of ran into?
I think, to me, I don't think anybody played out the timeline. I mean, if this thing was meticulous with the timeline, we wouldn't have them jogging a mile over to kill Tippett in 12 minutes, right? You know, we wouldn't have them on the drinking a Coke on the second floor when, you know, like, I don't think anybody put this all together. I think there's so much confusion that the more confusion they can throw at you, the less likely you find the truth.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. You know, I didn't even think about that as like affirmative propaganda. So there's, you know, there's not true because it's ridiculous. There's not true because there's two Oswalds, and there's not true because that's propaganda. So that actually, that is maybe the Occam's razor of it all, probably lands there. That's
interesting. I mean, I don't know, you know, I have grandchildren now, but when I was 15, the last thing I was thinking about was communism. I'm sorry, you know, I mean, 15-year-old kids, their hormones are raging. Boys are raging. I mean, that's what you're thinking about.
Right. Yeah, that's true. All right, so let's look at the next issue, which is the big question is, was Oswald at Beauregard Junior High School in New Orleans for the fall of eighth grade? So the Beauregard, this all comes down to a single document, which is the Beauregard report card. And the one that we have for Oswald that's in the Warren Report records has both of the school years that he attended Beauregard on the same card. the 53-54 school year, and then the 54-55 school year. For 53-54, Oswald should have arrived in early January of 1954 because that's when he left New York. But the document shows a line for the fall semester and also a line for the spring semester for that school year. And it looks like it shows that Oswald went to school for 89 days on the document. Of course, this can't be possible because he was in New York City for all of fall semester. Here's where rebuttal number three comes in. The Beauregard report card doesn't really mean that 89 days were missed. The 89-day number that's in the far right column labeled re-add, what that number shows is the number used to add up the number of absences to reach the total number of days. So that doesn't mean present. It means that's how many other days there were that the person wasn't absent. It sounds implausible to me. I looked at that argument, and that just, it sounds like a really confusing way to do records. So I was not sold on that argument. But when looking at the report card again, there's another argument that did get my attention. I noticed that it says on the report card, originally admitted 1954-113. So to me, that's a red flag that does undermine the whole 89 days number. I mean, if it says right there he was originally admitted on, you know, January 13th of 1954, that seems to put the 89 days thing to rest, and maybe that person's right. But to me, that's hard to get past. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with that. I think, you know, to me, it tells me that day is, why would they put that there if it wasn't? And then that would line up the timeline if he was there in January. Right. So I kind of agree with you on that.
Yeah. So, hey, you know, Harvey and Lee fans, hang with me. All right. Stay a second. I'm not just, you know, finding against Mr. Armstrong and everything. Like I said, there's some good stuff here. We're going one issue at a time. Next question. Is Myra DeRoos, by the way, I said DeRouse. That is incorrect. It's Myra DeRoos. So the question is she legit or not? Is she credible? Because a lot of, you know, what we're trying to figure out in the information we covered comes down to things that she said. So, you know, whether or not she's credible is the question. So who is she? She's a former gym teacher at Beauregard, and she claims to have been Oswald's homeroom teacher. And she said that he went by Harvey. Hey, that's the same name that the guy in North Dakota went by, that maybe the CIA invented. She said that Ed Vogel was Oswald's friend in the spring of 1954 in eighth grade, and that she would see Vogel hang out with Oswald sometimes. And that one day, Vogel said a piano fell on him, and she ended up giving Oswald a ride to the clinic because his mom couldn't be reached because she was working. And then she gave him a ride to his house, gave him a ride back home to his apartment. And she says that the place that she dropped him off was Exchange Place. And that was about a year before the Warren Report says that Oswald lived at Exchange Place. He was supposed to be living at, I believe, 1454 St. Mary's, the place they were renting for Myrtle Evans. So DeRoos says that the FBI told her that we would not know the truth about the assassination in our lifetime. So that's kind of a big statement that she made. And also that her interview with the FBI was immediately after the assassination and not months later, like what the FBI report says. Now, the only counterpoint that I could find to DeRoos is that she's either mistaken or she's just trying to get attention when it comes to this Exchange Place location. But that is something that, once again, we have these discrepancies. I would say the fact that the FBI knew to interview DeRoos at all indicates that she probably had some contact with Oswald. And, you know, the school admin wouldn't have pointed the FBI to go talk to her if not. So I think DeRoos is credible. We know for sure the years that she's talking about. So it's not like she's thinking of the wrong year. That's not really the case. It's either she's telling the truth about it or she's not, because she would have made it up later. So it's kind of inconclusive to me, but I don't have a reason to doubt DeRoos. What about you?
I agree. I mean, like, why would she make this up? Like, I mean, it's not her 20 seconds of fame, right? And she can clearly, you know, he was there. She clearly, you know, the piano incident, she gave him a ride. Like, why would she make any of that up? And I agree. It's like I often ask myself, how did anybody know that Oswald was the guy that they had to arrest after the assassination? Like, how would the FBI know to interview her? Like, did they just go to the phone book and start looking for people to interview? Like, I mean, like where is this coming from? There seems to be somebody pointing them in a direction. Who is the somebody? I don't know. I don't know who it is. Is it the Wizard of Oz behind some curtain? I don't know.
Well, they say it was Howard Brennan. He said, there's a 5'8" white guy in the window with a white shirt.
Right. I believe that. Looking from the bottom floor. Did anybody, you know, every time I listen to Howard Brennan's testimony, I think of the scene in My Cousin Vinny when they put that lady on the stand who can't see and they ask her what her glasses look like. Nobody's ever given Howard Brennan an eye exam. Nobody ever gave him an eye exam. Nobody ever asked him what he could see or duplicate or make him duplicate what he saw from the ground floor looking up six stories.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a toughie. I wrote a chapter in the Chokeholds book on Oswald being in place on the sixth floor. So I'm with you. Next question, which is kind of related to the last one. So Ed Vogel is the guy that DeRusse says that Oswald was closest to in eighth grade. He's the guy that came running to let her know that a piano had fallen on him. And she says she would see him riding bikes with Vogel and Oswald. But, you know, Vogel doesn't mention this piano incident at all during his Warren Report deposition. So that either, and that's a pretty big thing, a piano falling on the guy that you're there to talk about. Like, that's a major distinct incident. So that either cuts against DeRusse's credibility, because you would think Vogel would bring that up, or it implies that Vogel may not have believed that the piano incident happened with Lee Harvey Oswald, because he thought that was just some guy named Harvey who he was friends with, but not close enough to know his last name. And I'm not sure how I feel about that idea, but that's why I really was focusing on DeRusse's credibility, because it weighs on the, why didn't Vogel talk about the piano incident then? What do you think about that?
I think that's something that I want to ask you. Why didn't Vogel talk about this 15-year-old kid wanting to kill the president? Because if he wanted to do it in North Dakota, how come he doesn't want to do it in New Orleans?
Right. He doesn't bring that up in New Orleans.
It doesn't. Of course, it doesn't carry over, right? Like, where's that? If you have a passion to kill the president at 15 and you believe in communism, then Vogel, why isn't he wanted? Why isn't he another? There's a pattern here. Every time you want to build a pattern, there's a pattern breaker.
Right. Yes. Okay, here we go. Here's a pretty big one. We have about three left. Did Lee Harvey Oswald ever attend Stripling Junior High School? In particular, the fall of 1954 is the time frame, but really any time. So again, this is one more conflict in time frames allegation. We know that Oswald is at Beauregard for the full time for the fall of 1954. Robert Oswald, he's the one that starts this whole Stripling thing. You got to go back to Robert Oswald. So it does start based on something credible. He told the Warren Commission that Lee went to Stripling Junior High School, although he says that it was for seventh grade. We know that's not true because Lee was in New York then. But he also says that Lee would have went to Stripling, which is almost implying that it didn't really happen. Like, he would have, but for something else. But Robert Oswald also told the Fort Worth newspapers that Lee went to Stripling in 1959 when he was interviewed after his brother had attempted to defect to the Soviet Union, and in 1962 when his brother returned. So he's continually saying it. Frank Cudlady, he's the guy who was an assistant principal on the day and says that he went in, was called by the principal, met the FBI, gave him the school records, and it showed that Oswald went to school there for, you know, no more than 6 weeks. A lot of this whole story with Oswald going to Stripling hinges on Cudlady's story about the FBI coming to that school and getting the records being true. Like, if Cudlady's not telling the truth, then it's all like, it really is a central point of that. But again, another credibility question. This guy later goes on to be the superintendent of schools for Waco. Now, do psychopaths make it to high offices? All the time. Actually, most of the people in the highest offices are. Okay. But nevertheless, you know, typically there would be some credibility in that. You don't reach that just by, you know, making things up. So again, either he was credible or he was really, really just maniacal, really are the options. But we also have four witnesses who say, we don't just have Cudlady. We don't just have Robert Oswald's mysterious talk about Stripling. Mm-hmm. We got him plus Cudlady. Plus you have the principal Ricardo Galindo saying it's common knowledge Oswald went here. I put 0.0 into that because you're not, it's meaningless. But we also have four witnesses who say that Oswald lived across the street from the school basketball court. Three witnesses, Franzetta Schubert, Doug Gann, and Bobby Pitts. So all these people say the same thing, and Armstrong interviewed them. So here is rebuttal number four. It is insane to believe that Oswald went to Stripling. These statements were obtained from John Armstrong, not under oath. Each of these witnesses is either confused or is wrong, and John Armstrong asked them leading questions. Okay, look, I don't see any individual reasons to throw out their testimony because they did go to school then. It wasn't making them say these things. If you watch the video, he's asking them the questions he wants answers to, but he's not putting words in their mouth. I mean, I think they had the agency to say what they wanted to say. But so to me, I can't just say this is crazy. I'm going to eliminate all their testimony. But I don't think that all this is enough to prove that Oswald went to Stripling. So I don't have rock solid evidence. I'm certain he went to Stripling. But I think it's enough to make it possible that he did. I think we really have to leave that open because Robert Oswald continually said it. Frank Cudlady's credible. And we have those three witnesses that all reference the same thing. What do you think about Stripling?
I agree. I think it's credible. I don't think you can just ignore it, especially with the witness testimony and, you know, the fact that, you have the records that's documented. I think to me, Armstrong has no motive in this thing. He's not trying to frame it. You don't spend 20 hours a day in that damn archive with a motive. I mean, you know, I think he's like anything you do, you try to begin without the end in mind. And this to me is you've got to acknowledge these. No people are going to continue to lie for no reason.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I think too. That's real. I mean, the implications are, okay, well, then there must have been a different person. Now, that doesn't mean that this is a doppelganger or look-alike. It could just be someone impersonating him. You know what I mean? Who's, you know, we don't really know for sure from the records. So let's look at the next issue, just a couple more. We're going to go Civil Air Patrol. So there's not really a dispute here. So this is a quick one to touch on. It used to be a question, did Oswald know David Ferry? And that seemed really salacious. So it was just sort of a matter of course. Warren Report defenders would say, no, of course not. That's ridiculous. But then a photo came out on a PBS documentary, and that kind of changed things. So the whole issue is, there's a photo with Lee Harvey Oswald when he's in the Civil Air Patrol, and David Ferry is his squad leader. And there's a photo of him having a barbecue with David Ferry. Now, a lot of people put Ferry in the center of the assassination conspiracy, and having Oswald know him at age 15, that's crazy. It shows that it's possible that Oswald could have reunited with him again later. If he's just some lone nut, then why does he know this guy that would be, you know, accused of killing the president by Jim Garrison years later? That's too close of a connection. I mean, this, not everybody in the world's having that happen. So the real question is, did Oswald also know Ferry in the summer of 1963, which we'll get to later, you know, when it comes to New Orleans. The other thing I look at here is, if Oswald was really a communist, like, you know, the stories go about him, why would he have wanted to join the Civil Air Patrol? It's kind of related to, why would he want to join the Marines? I mean, why would he want to join something that seems like it's not, the anti-establishment? It's like the most establishment thing you could do. What do you think about that?
I agree. I think there's a narrative and then there's a reality. Like, nothing lines up, right? And there's a reason Ferry's. Now, I'm not sure Ferry knew what his job was in this thing, but he was one of the pawns in this giant chessboard. And him having an association with Bannister, him having an association with Clay Shaw, him having an association with Oswald, that's just not happenstance. Like, that's just not happenstance. Like, those, like, that doesn't make any sense at all. You can pretend it doesn't, but now you know, if you don't believe, then let's go back to how that bullet just changed directions. Like, all this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's like in the in episode 27, I had the whole thing where I listed, if you believe a conspiracy, you have to believe these things that are hard to swallow. If you build Warren Report Defender, you have to believe these things. And I think there are some people who's, you know, you have to go issue by issue. But if your settings based on your life experiences have happened in a certain way, I suppose you could land there. I can't. But nevertheless, last issue, this is a big one. When was Lee Harvey Oswald working at the Pfisterer Dental Lab? Well, the Warren Report says that happened from mid-January to July of 1956, somewhere in that range for several months. We don't know how many months. And then after that, he joined the Marines in October of 1956. But Palmer McBride told the FBI that from December of 1957 until May of 1958, he worked with Oswald at the Pfisterer Dental Lab in New Orleans, which is impossible because Oswald was stationed in Atsugi, Japan at that time. Now, again, this is one more, he said, she said, he said, he said scenario. Well, we have to weigh witness credibility. But there are some things that really make it more clear to me that we should take McBride seriously. He has specific reference points that we can trace to specific dates and time. So, for example, he says that he and Oswald went to the Boris Godunov Opera. Well, that opera only was in New Orleans on October 10th and October 12th of 1957. This is because Palmer McBride's father managed the opera theater, so they were able to get tickets to that. Imelda Smith, who worked at Pfisterer Dental Lab, said that she heard Oswald and Palmer talk about the recent success the Russians were having in the space race. Now, Sputnik was on October 10th of 1957, and Laika the dog was November 17th of 1957. Whether or not the Russians had success in the space race during 1956, because there's a lot of this talk about the Russian space race success that it's tethered to this. This is hotly disputed on the message boards. But I spent about an hour yesterday looking at Russian space race history, deep diving, trying to find any successes in 1956. Crickets. There's nothing. I can tell you that's not, they're talking about 1957. They're talking about Sputnik and Laika. They have to be. James Vance says that he met Oswald around the time he had a party at his house for the launch of the first U.S. satellite aboard Explorer 1, and we know that satellite launch happened on January 31st, 1958. Palmer McBride says that William Gerke also had a meeting of the New Orleans Amateur Astronomy Association at his house in early 1958. William Wolfe, another guy, was at that meeting. And he was asked by the Warren Commission, they're trying to peg down a time for, whoa, when was this meeting? And they asked him, well, did you know Oswald in 1955? And he said, William Wolfe said, yes, but it's sketchy. I cannot say for sure. I could get the date from the Astronomy Club records. So he's saying, I don't know. It's all, surrounds this Astronomy Club meeting. Well, he was able to figure out what the date was and reference a calendar and look at the dates. And it was sometime in early January of 1958. That's what he told John Armstrong. Again, you can say, throw out everything John Armstrong says because I don't trust him. Okay, fine. But if you're going to do that, apply that standard to everyone. Paul Fiorello says that Oswald started in late 1957 at Pfisterer. So again, this is one more thing. All right. Rebuttal number 5 on this exact same point. You are completely leaving out the W-2 for 1956 that's in the Warren Report records. Also, Paul Fiorello said that he worked with Oswald in 1956 per FBI reports. So thank you. That is true. And there is a W-2 record. I did mention that, I believe, in the podcast episode. But in light of the fact that Palmer McBride provides all of this detail with the fixed points in time Annie has a sworn affidavit saying that Oswald was there at a different time. I would expect there to be more records than just this single W-2. There's no time cards, no applications, no, you know, day-to-day documents showing that Oswald worked there. You know, it's typical business records. And regarding Paul Fiorello, it's true that his FBI statement does say that it was about 1956 when Oswald worked at Pfisterer. But John Armstrong interviewed him in 1994, and he told Oswald, John Armstrong interviewed Fiorello in 1994, and Fiorello told him that Oswald started working there in late 1957, which is contrary to the FBI report. But given that we have other witnesses that also accused the FBI of changing their testimony, it's not as simple as just going with the FBI report and then ignoring everything that Armstrong said. My conclusion on this extremely controversial topic is that given the corroboration of these specific dates and events, I tend to believe Palmer McBride's story, which causes serious problems for me because that would mean that the person known as Lee Harvey Oswald is in two places at the same time. What do you say about that, sir?
I agree with you, but now we're in 1957, 58, and we're about to see a bunch of Lee Harvey Oswalds creep up, whether one's at the shooting range, whether one is hitchhiking to work with curtain rods in the car, whether one's at the Dobbs family house having coffee, giving a does stare to Officer Tippett. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think these people, I think this W-2 comes in there to clarify and, you know, it just brushes everything away, but there's nothing else to back up the W-2. And you've got all this other evidence that backs up all these other people. So, yeah, I don't see how you can just say Armstrong's completely wrong. He's got too much information and they refuse to give information.
And the starting point was the Palmer McBride FBI report. And these dates are in the FBI report. It's not like all these dates that I'm talking about just came from Armstrong. The only thing that you have to rely on Armstrong for is specifically Paul Fiorello. I mean, everything else is FBI reports. So,
So this is like a book. This is like a book where we know the ending, but they're trying to change the beginning of the book to fit the ending.
Right.
And they can't quite get that done.
Right. Well, hey, we covered all of the big topics that we were going to cover. Anything else you want to talk about when it comes to young Oswald?
No, I think to me, this is great. I love the fact, I love it. I think, you know, I love how you challenged Posner to come on. I kill Posner on Twitter. I try to challenge
I know you
him
do.
Too. Because here's what I believe. And I said this to you before we started. Jack Nicholson has the greatest line of all. He says, I love discourse. I'm dying to have my mind changed. I'm probably the only liberal who read Treason by Ann Coulter. I want to know. I want to understand. I like listening to everybody. This, to me, is the elixir of life. And mm-hmm. I'll close with that, because I think if you're not willing to look at both sides, you have no chance to learn the truth.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael, for coming on the show. We appreciate it. Keep crushing and literally everything you do.
And you keep crushing it. You keep doing great work, my man. Keep it going. I'll get everybody. We'll rally behind you. Thank
you. Appreciate
you.
We'd love to have you back on sometime in the future. And you
anytime.
Have a great weekend.
Thank
Cheers.
You.
Next week on Solving JFK, we begin our series on Oswald in the Marines. What can we learn about what Oswald was like as a person? And are there any more of these record discrepancies when it comes to his time in the military?
If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
I'm just happy.